Accession number 17734, Reel 2.
Mr. Passmore, Reel 2.
Yes. Soon after that particular episode, we pulled up alongside one of our guns, which was shorthanded, so I joined it as a loader. And we opened fire on a German plane coming over, and to my horror, when the first shot went off, there was a tinkle, tinkle, and the whole of the breech fell out of the back. So that was the end of that particular gun, and the end of my participation in that part of the action, because some tanks appeared out of a wood and opened fire on us, and one of the shells, we were just leaving the gun and getting onto a vehicle to get the hell out of it, and one of the shells landed underneath the vehicle, blew me straight through the canvas roof, alright, we eventually scrambled out of that and continued, but by that time it was a complete rout, because as I say, there were no communication between headquarters and individual units, other than dispatch riders, most of whom had been killed or wounded or knocked off their vehicles. You just hoped that you would meet another part of the regiment and continue the way they were going. We eventually arrived at the outskirts of Dunkirk, and my troop commander said to me, right, we have instructions to go to so-and-so, which was Le Pan. We're going down this road. You stay here and direct any other of our vehicles this way. And I stood at that crossroad directing the odd vehicles of ours. And, of course, other vehicles would come up and say, have you heard of the 11th Lancers? Do you know where so-and-so is? Where have they set up a headquarters? If you remembered a previous vehicle with the same number on the back going the other way, you sent them along that road, you helped when you could. The following day, one of my friends came out and he said, I'm to relieve you. And I trudged down over the sands to the sea, found where the adjutant and a knot of our people were, and they were walking out into the sea, and men were being picked up in small rowing boats and being ferried out to larger vessels that were laying offshore. There seemed to be no rhyme or reason, because you would walk out into the water up to your waist, find that the small boat was full, walk back again. The next boat that came in would come alongside a crowd of servicemen who'd only just arrived on the beach, and they would be taken off. And gradually, as the numbers reduced, we made our way slowly towards Dunkirk. Again, there were no rations being issued. We were filthy, unshaven, which is unusual for the army. So I broke away, went into Dunkirk town, which by that time was being shelled quite badly, and found a grocery store, loaded up my pack with tins of food, came back and shared this out amongst the others. I personally remember to this day opening a tin of asparagus tips and loving every single one of them, because not only were there asparagus tips, but the liquid that they were in. We'd already used our emergency rations. We'd emptied our water bottles. so glad of any substance, sustenance at all. Eventually, I arrived at the entrance to Dunkirk Harbour, the Mole, and by this time there were larger vessels coming into the harbour. We walked along the Mole, and very soon after this, the harbour started to be shelled. The Germans had got nearer to the town and were able to shell the harbour. And the end of the Mole was, there were planks. Some of these were therefore broken by the shells, and you were clambering across the holes until eventually got to the end. By that time, it was towards the end of the day. A destroyer pulled up nearby, and the captain said, "It's too dangerous to tie up, but if any of you lads like to jump, risk it. I'll get my fellows to line up against the rail and help you aboard." And I was one of the people that jumped. I mean, all right, it was a question of did you fall between the boat and get crushed between the boat and the side of the harbour, or did you stay where you were and get killed by German shells? So it was, you know, a better bet to jump. Jumped, landed on the rail, and a sailor pulled me in. And as soon as the decks were covered with troops, we pulled away back towards Dover, and they gave us a straight loaf of bread and a mug of cocoa.
Which ship was this?
HMS Vimy. I'll always remember it.
HMS what?
Vimy. From the name of, you know, Vimy Ridge from the First World War. Got back to Dover, unloaded. There was a train waiting there. They gave us a telegram form to send to our nearest relatives to say that we were safe. And they gave us again something to eat, some sandwiches to take with us. Next thing we knew, we were in Swindon.
Going back to Dunkirk, how were people behaving on the beaches towards each other?
I thought extremely well, except that we were getting a bit crossed that people were being taken off who'd only just arrived, and some of us who'd been several days on the beach, you know, hadn't been taken off. And we were being bombed. I perhaps could say that we'd formed up in threes to march to Dunkirk Harbour itself when it became obvious that few rowing boats were coming in from larger ships. And we were bombed there. Obviously, you were more scared of the noise. The dive bombers coming down made a terrific noise, and you always felt they were coming straight at you. And one stick of bombs crossed the column that I was in. The fellow who was furthest away from the bomb was killed. The man who was next to me was wounded. And I was nearest the bomb. Luckily, they were small ones. And I was covered with sand, and they had to dig me out. So that was another set of bruises to add to the ones that I'd had when the tank shelled us. But, you know, you kept going. Self-preservation, you know. the nearer the mole, the better chance you had of being got off. But there were no orders coming from anywhere. There were, as far as I knew, it was almost each man for himself. You made your own decisions, whether you made for the mole or whether you waited for a boat to pick you up.
Was there any sense of disgruntlement or a tendency to blame anybody for the situation?
Well, I think from the time we landed in France, we felt that the whole thing was completely disorganized. A little bit on our particular regiment, because we had been told that the next war would be a war of tanks, and therefore that we as light anti-aircraft would be mobile, and instead of being mobile we were stuck at this aerodrome not doing what we were trained for, and of course it did become a war of mobility, and I don't think anybody was prepared for it. As I say, we had at that stage no radio communication, nothing but dispatch riders, and therefore communication for mobile warfare was impossible. And we realised this. We blamed the hierarchy I had seen a war coming for 18 months. Presumably, the powers that be should have seen a war coming earlier than that. We were Bofors guns, which were made in Sweden, but we only had one third of our official number to start with. And the result was that two thirds of the regiment was there. They had some Lewis guns, but Lewis guns against dive bombers were pretty impotent. And you felt impotent. You felt that as I say, we were in holes in the ground. We didn't get tents until the end of January 1940. And even those conditions in a tent were pretty abysmal in the weather, because by that time you had this terrible winter with feet of snow. It wasn't until probably about the middle of November a mobile bath unit came up to see us about once a month. I had joined, as I say, the beginning of 1939. I was there in what I can describe as a First World War artillery uniform, complete with brass buttons. Fellows who joined later had got battle dress, but people who joined later hadn't even got an overcoat. And we were issued with two blankets per man. But when the snow came down, two blankets per man, it was appalling. We were frozen to death. And even the battery headquarters people were in Nissen huts in the centre of this little village. And they were so badly put together that the wind whistled underneath the floor. And it was, other than the fact it was dry, they weren't much better off than we were, although they were better off. There we are.
Was there any tendency to blame people for the military setback in May 1940?
I think it was this general feeling that it was to be expected, because we hadn't got the equipment. We certainly blamed the French, and very definitely the Belgians, because the Belgians poured through us They looked as if they'd never fired a shot. We wanted them to turn around and help fight, and they didn't. They just got the hell out of it in the same way as the French civilians did, blocking the roads.
Now, you was to tell me about the reformation in Britain.
Yeah, I, as I say, I landed in, landed up in Swindon. They put us into a school hall, slept on the floor. I slept for about 24 hours. The following morning, the first thing I realised was that I hadn't shaved for probably a fortnight, which was terrible. So I went into town, found a barber and had a shave. Then realised that I was in a pretty bad way as far as the back was concerned. As far as I can remember, there was no organisation again there. So I got myself to the local hospital, where they took an x-ray of my back and said, oh, well, you know, you're a fit young man, rest and you'll be all right. We heard rumours that people who come back from Dunkirk were having 48 hours to go home, went round, tried to find somebody who would give me permission to go home, couldn't find anybody. After waiting around for several days, I eventually just paid for my own railway fare to get back to Sidmouth, found my mother in a terrible state because she was quite convinced that I was dead. The telegram that I'd sent had never reached home. Part of 151 battery, which I was in, had finished up in Calais, and they'd got out from Calais, got home, and my mother had said, well, you know, any of you know what's happened to Richard? And the answer was, no, they didn't know. Then some others came back from Dunkirk, and they remembered the occasion when the tanks had caught up with us, and they said, oh, yes, the tanks had caught up with us. They heard that I'd been hurt. And so she thought that I was either dead or a German POW. So she was in a terrible state. There we are. I had my 48 hours at home, went back, still found that there was no organisation at all. Eventually, I found out the regiment was reforming at St Agnes in Cornwall, at the pre-war practice camp there for light anti-aircraft. So got myself down to St Agnes. We were in tents there, and the regiment had started off as 550 territorials. At the outbreak of war, we'd been made up to 1,000 by 450 reservists being posted to us. That was a bit of a shock, because they had done 7 years at least in the army, were then on the regular army reserve and being called back. They just started themselves off as civilians. Many of them had got married, and they were very disgruntled. They knew all the tricks of the trade, and not one of them had risen above the rank of Lance Bombardier. They were all busted back to gunner, and very reluctant to serve under TA sergeants, some of whom had only been in the TA 12 months. but anyway, out of that 1,000, there were very few at St Agnes. We were there for a couple of weeks in tents. Then all things were moved to Paignton. We took over a holiday camp at Paignton. Gradually, people came back out of hospital in one place and another. But there were 350 people who never came back. They were either killed, so badly wounded that they were invalided out, or POWs. From Paignton, we went to Hornchurch in Essex, where again we were put quite rightly there. The army foresaw that aerodromes would be bombed as the first attempt to invade Britain, and we were sent there. We had one Bofors gun on the aerodrome, and the Lewis guns that we brought back from France, such as were left, and that's all. So we dug ourselves slip trenches all around the aerodrome and just sat there, and when we were bombed we could do nothing except cower in slit trenches.
This is Hornchurch, you say?
Yeah.
How much...
In Essex.
How many enemy attacks, how much in the way of enemy attacks was there?
I don't know. Quite a lot. I mean, it was one of the first line aerodromes that they were bombing.
How frightening was it?
Very. Because we knew the sort of thing that could happen, and you could foresee, you know, if they knocked out all our aeroplanes, that they would be coming in and landing their troops there. And of course we were frightened to death of German parachutists, having heard about the parachute drops that there had been in Poland and elsewhere.
This, of course, was the Battle of Britain period.
Yeah. So we were there for that. And then some guns were allocated to us, some Bofors. We had some guns at Manston, again, too, on that aerodrome.
Did you go to Manston?
No. By this time, luckily, we had a new colonel, and he sort of obviously knew army instructions, and for the first time had said, there are some of you people who ought to have a commission. And I said, well, I'd like to apply for a commission. So I had a medical board and was downgraded from A1 to B something or other, partly this back, partly on the basis of my eyesight. So I applied for a commission in the RASC, RAOC, or because I was a chartered accountant, I had to make a third choice, and I applied for the pay corps. I didn't want to be, I mean, I'd be no good as a signaller or an engineer. And I certainly didn't want to be in the infantry. When I joined the TA, my father had said, whatever you do, don't join the infantry. I was in the infantry, and no future for you in that, and that's why I joined the Royal Artillery. So I applied for a commission and sort of was in limbo for several months until the beginning of January 1941, when I was summoned for an OCTU for the pay corps, which I went to, passed. I was then posted to Leeds, which was the first time that I'd had, you know, a decent billet to live in and sleep in, and literally I was going to say a 9-to-5 office job to do. I had been there for 8 months when I was warned for overseas. By that time I'd just about paid off the overdraft I got by my officer's kit, and lo and behold I had to go and get tropical kit. Didn't know where I was going, but I was told to buy tropical kit. Was given a week's leave, embarkation leave, went home, went to the local tailor at Exeter. He made my things up. I was by this time in a terrible state, because before I left for home, they'd given me every conceivable inoculation, and I'd run a tremendous temperature. But knowing that I'd only got a week in which to get all my kit together, you know, went in, spent most of the rest of the time in bed at home, got half my kit from the tailor, and reported in London. I was in London for December 1941, waiting a posting. Luckily, the rest of the kit turned up from the tailor. Then joined a ship at Liverpool on a draft of individual officers, still not knowing where we were going. 5 weeks at sea, again, very crowded conditions, small ship, which had been an armed merchant cruiser. And they'd taken the guns off her, and they were still converting her as we sailed. So she was top-heavy and rolled about 30-odd degrees. So the men were very seasick. 5 weeks later, we landed in Durban. When we landed, we were told, oh, well, everybody stays here for 3 months and you'll have a marvellous time and go and see so-and-so and so-and-so. Went to a transit camp following day. Went into town, and I settled down, found out which was the best hotel, went into town to have dinner. Just started dinner when there was an announcement from the vehicle and the loudspeaker, everybody in convoy so-and-so to report back to camp immediately. I finished my meal, went back to camp. Following morning, went back, joined another ship, went to Bombay. From Bombay, went up to Deal Alley, the Royal Artillery Depot there. And again, because I'd been in the Royal Artillery, there were masses of men there who had to be kept busy. It was as simple as that. So I was playing hockey in the morning before breakfast, after breakfast taking square drill, then after coffee had a rest, and then played tennis. After lunch, went back to your bungalow and rested. In the evening, I was refereeing hockey between English teams and Indian teams. The Indians beat us hollow. And that was a very interesting 6 weeks. I mean, life in India, an army station, was obviously extremely luxurious. The big trouble was, of course, that we were still on British radio.